What's up, Betamaxers? Welcome to Celluloid Fever Dreams, a weekly dive into the overlooked and underappreciated films of cinematic history. As always, I'm your host, the relatable, the inflatable, it's debatable, Wyndham Jennings. This week's film is from 2001, and honestly, I feel like this has turned into a bona fide cult classic by this point. It's seen a resurgence over the past couple of years, and I've noticed a few other podcasts talking about it. But it stars Rachel Lee Cook, Rosario Dawson, and Tara Reid. This week we're talking about Josie and the Pussycats. As always, we start with our two-second synopsis. Campy girl power happens. And if we're going to be period accurate, of course, girl is spelt capital G, six R's, and an L. For a little bit of a longer synopsis, struggling girl group, the Pussycats, is signed by Mega Records Corp. and quickly become the biggest artists on the planet. However, they find out that Megacore is using their music to brainwash the masses with subliminal messaging. So the Pussycats must figure out a way to put an end to this conspiracy before their first stadium concert is broadcast worldwide. Now, if you're sitting there thinking to yourself, you know, Wyndham, you're not what I would consider the target audience for this kind of film. Yeah, you're right. And when the film came out 20 years ago, I still wasn't the target audience for it. But it doesn't change the fact that I genuinely enjoy this film and I've watched it multiple times over the years. It's genuinely one of those films that when it came out, I could not understand why it wasn't a bigger hit, but why it wasn't a hit at all. It was a really bad flop at the box office. And I just couldn't get that. And I'm really glad to see that it's starting to, you know, build in popularity. Last year, for the 20th anniversary, they did, I believe it was Alamo, did a screening and brought a lot of the cast back together and the writing and directing team of Deborah Kaplan and Harry Elfont to do kind of an oral history and answer questions from the audience about the film. The soundtrack was reissued on vinyl. And the movie finally got a Blu-ray release. And bonus, the Blu-ray is the theatrical version of the film, not the family-friendly version that was released alongside the original DVD. Confused yet? Yeah, this is going to be kind of a journey. It's going to be a little bit of a twisty ride. As I said, the film was written and directed by the team of Deborah Kaplan and Harry Elfont. The two of them were coming off the success of teen comedy Can't Hardly Wait when they were handed the Josie and the Pussycats assignment. Besides those two films, the pair also worked on A Very Brady sequel, Flintstones' Viva Rock Vegas, Maid of Honor, and the TV shows Mary and Jane and Liza on Demand. Josie and the Pussycats would be the last feature film the duo would direct, though. And honestly, looking at their filmography, I think this is their peak. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, Josie and the Pussycats, looking at the films leading up to it, seemed to be the one, and Can't Hardly Wait was there as well, where they finally found their groove and the rhythm, I think, is the best way to put it. It's like those are the two films they seem to just hit on all cylinders to me. You know, the writing, the cast, the soundtracks, just, you know, everything seemed to come together to make two really good films. And I honestly wish Josie and the Pussycats had been a bigger hit, because I'd have loved to have seen where they would have gone if they kept having, you know, kept working on feature films as a writer and director duo. Now, diving a little bit into Josie and the Pussycats and the history, because I just kind of want to dive into it a little bit, because I feel like when I get to the part of why I don't think the film did as well as it did when it was first released, I kind of want to give you a little background on the history of the characters themselves. If you ask most people around my age about Josie and the Pussycats, they'll tell you about the TV series. Josie and the Pussycats were the stars of two different TV series. I'm not old enough to have seen them in first run, but I did catch them in reruns when I was a child in the late 70s. Of course, the titular Josie and the Pussycats, which was kind of like Scooby-Doo, It was Josie and Melody and Valerie, Alexander and Alexandra, the twins that managed them, and Alan M., who was Josie's boyfriend, traveling the world and playing shows, and then somehow getting involved in a local mystery. However, unlike Scooby-Doo, a lot of it wasn't supernatural. They tended to be like super scientists or evil scientists or, you know, things more along those lines. And every episode featured at least one song performed by the band, original music written for the TV series. But they started out as comic book characters for Archie Comics, as a matter of fact. And in fact, there wouldn't be a Josie TV series if it wasn't for the fact that that Archie and his gang had gotten an animated series earlier in the 60s. And Archie had started a band, and the song Sugar Sugar, which was written for the show, actually charted on the American Billboard charts and spun off from a cartoon TV show. So the film is a weird mix of the cartoons. Well, I'm going to say a weird mix, but it draws from the cartoon as well as the original comics. Characters are created by Dan DiCarlo, who got his start working with Stan Lee on the comic Millie the Model back in the late 40s, early 50s. He started working for Archie Comics in 1951, and his art style became the Archie standard style. When he was hired by the company, he told them that he was having some trouble matching their style guide, you know, what the characters were supposed to look like according to the company. And so the company told him, said, well, draw them in your style. And they were so impressed by it that his style became the house style for Archie Comics for decades. DiCarlo would also co-create the Archie characters Sabrina the Teenage Witch and Cheryl Blossom. Josie herself is actually based on DiCarlo's wife, who he met in Belgium in the 40s while fighting in World War II. Her look, her haircut, even the cat outfits that the Pussycats wear are all based on his wife and the cat costume on a costume she wore for a Halloween party while they was on vacation. Josie and Melody made their debut in February of 1963. First issue of the Josie comic come out. It would be 45 issues of Josie before it became Josie and the Pussycats, as her and Melody decided to start a band. And that's where Valerie made her first appearance. In fact, the original cartoon actually holds a place in television history. It premiered on September 12, 1970, and ran for 16 episodes. The network originally wanted to redesign Valerie so that she was a white girl, but Danny Jensen, who was the producer of the music and had put together an actual musical group to play the music, you know, the Pussycat songs, threatened to walk out if they changed the character design. And so Valerie became the first African-American female main character in a animated TV show. She just barely missed out on being the first African-American main character in a cartoon show. That record is held by the Hardy Boys cartoon. Honestly, until I started researching this movie, I didn't even know a Hardy Boys cartoon existed. But their friend Pete Jones holds the distinction of being the first African-American main character in a cartoon. Singer Patrice Holloway and actress Cheryl Ladd were both the singing voices for Josie in the original series and in the 1972 Josie and the Pussycats in Outer Space, where somehow the band wound up with a spaceship traveling from planet to planet, trying to find their way back to Earth. Now, the whole reason I went into this is for two reasons. In the pre-production for the movie, the live-action film we're talking about, they ran into problems because DiCarlo was fighting Archie Comics for the rights to the characters. He felt like that, you know, he owned them, and that Archie hadn't properly compensated him for them. So there was a court battle going on in the pre-production. DiCarlo ultimately lost. But two, the other reason I wanted to bring it up is that according to a few sources as I was researching this, and as always, you know, I try to get things as accurate as I can, but I'm one guy. So if I get something wrong, I apologize. And I found this in a couple of different sources, but from what I understand, one of the early drafts for the script was actually Josie and the Pussycats in Outer Space. And if the film had been successful, the sequel would have been Josie and the Pussycats in Outer Space. Now, if you remember, earlier I mentioned that there was two versions of the film on DVD, the theatrical cut and a family-friendly version. Now, I have not watched the family-friendly version. I don't own a copy of it. But from what I understand, there's very few cuts. Like I said, the film itself, the humor style of it, and kind of generally look of it, the bright colors, the oversaturation, what have you, kind of reminds me of the Austin Power films. You know, it's campy, it's tongue-in-cheek. There's nothing, it's rated PG-13, but really there's nothing in the film that I would not, I mean, I got a 10-year-old. I'd let her watch it. I mean, that's kind of the level of the humor. Probably the dirtiest joke in the entire film involves Melody. And it's in the beginning of the movie. She's standing by the side of the road holding up signs like, honk if you're happy, honk if you like puppies. And then the final sign, it's supposed to say, honk if you love pussycats. But for the beginning of the shot, the way she's standing, the cats part of the sign is hidden behind a tree trunk. Okay, well, that and there's a boy band in the film called Du Jour, and their hit single is called Backdoor Lover. And some of the lines in it are a little risque. I mean, I'm not going to say filthy, but, you know, if you're above a certain age, you'll get the double entendres. And Archie actually signed off on all of this. The only note I think that they gave, from what I've been able to find in my research, was they wanted a shot of the girls brushing their teeth. I guess just to like send a positive message to the kids. And in fact, I found a couple of sources saying the reason there was a quote unquote family friendly version was that Archie themselves were not happy with the film. But from what I could find, and I mean, I dug and dug and dug through the internet trying to find where this came from. And I even found a editorial written by the editor-in-chief of Archie right, you know, around the time the film was getting ready to come out. And what they weren't happy with is the PG-13 rating of the film. And the reason they weren't happy with it is Archie themselves did not believe the film deserved a PG-13 rating. He was actually responding to fans of the comics who were writing into the company asking, you know, why is this film PG-13? Why would you let, you know, Josie and the Pussycats be a PG-13 movie? And they were saying, we don't understand why it's a PG-13 movie. We've watched it, and to us, it's a PG film. And they actually, he talked about the Melody sign joke. And he said, honestly, he said, that's a joke that's just going to go right past, you know, any kid in the audience. That's a joke for the parents in the audience. But I could not find a reason why there exists a family-friendly version of the DVD. Anything I could say here would be speculation, unless Archie, just to maybe drive sales of the DVD, did put out a quote on, you know, got the studio to cut a couple of jokes. And I think I saw somewhere online that there's a couple of redubs because there, I don't know, there's no really foul language. I think the word bitch gets thrown around a couple of times. But, yeah, that's the only reason I can think why there would exist two reasons is maybe the company. And I could not find anything that would back that up. So, again, that's 100% speculation on my part. And looking at it, it's got a really good cast. Like I said, the writing's really good on it. The jokes hit fast. And you know, like I said, I keep comparing to Austin Powers, but there's a few fourth wall breaking moments. You know, like there's one where they're on the plane going to the big city and Alexander asks his sister why she's there. I mean, he's there. He's the manager of the band. She doesn't like the band. And he just looks at her and goes, why are you here? And she just straight faced goes, because I was in the comics. Or there's a scene where a couple of scenes where Alan Cummings mugs for the camera as his character, Wyatt. That are honestly, I think, some of the best parts of his performance. I really think as Wyatt, this is one of the best things I've ever seen him do. I hadn't seen every one of his films, but in terms of comedy, this is one of the best roles I've seen him in. And I say that even knowing that he's in the Spy Kids films. And yes, I've watched the Spy Kids films. Yes, I find them delightfully absurd and goofy and silly. No, they're not on my list of films to talk about on the podcast. But let's just go through the cast, because this is a really, you know, especially for the time, this is a really good cast. Even for today, this would be a really good cast put together for a comedy film. But we start out with the, you know, title character Josie McCoy. I did not know until I watched the film that she even had a last name. Played by Rachel Lee Cook, who was coming off of the success of She's All That and was kind of an it girl in Hollywood at the time. She's been in other films like Tom and Huck, The House of Yes, Nancy Drew. She's also done some TV work since this film come out. Melody, our ditzy drummer, is played by Tara Reid, who at the time was coming off the success of the American Pie films and The Big Lebowski. She's also appeared in the films Van Wilder, Urban Legend. She is in the Sharknado series. And Valerie, the bassist, played by Rosario Dawson. You may know her from other films like Rent, Sin City, Kids, He Got Game, Men in Black 2, and Death Proof. For the role, Dawson actually got her hair permed, so it'd be curly and look more like the character in the cartoon and the comics, and so that she absolutely hated it. She hated the way that it looked on her in the film. She said that it actually made her look much bigger than her co-stars, Tara Reid and Rachel Lee Cook, who are a little bit more petite than Rosario Dawson anyway. I actually got to meet Rosario Dawson not long after Sin City had come out in theaters. She was at a comic convention that me and my wife went to. We were just dating at the time. And so I got her autograph. I to this day regret that I didn't get her to autograph the Josie and the Pussycats DVD. I'd forgot to take it with me. But I got her to sign. She had written a comic book. Had a graphic novel. I got her to sign that. But to this day, I do have the memory of standing in line and hearing all these guys walk up to her and going, "I loved you in Sin City. I thought you were great in Sin City. You know, I thought you were just wonderful in Sin City," of, you know, buying the graphic novel and handing it to her. And as she's signing it, going, "I loved you in Josie and the Pussycats." Just the look on her. She actually stopped signing the autograph to look at me like I was a crazy person, and then just laughed and told me that that's not a film she actually gets a lot of people complimenting her on. And then she said that it was actually one of the best films she had worked on. So that, you know, they had a lot of fun filming it. She made a lot of friends on it. And she actually said that she didn't think anybody had ever seen the film, given how little at the time people had talked to her about it. The Pussycats manager, Alexander, is played by Paolo Costanzo, who we talked about earlier this year in the film Splinter. He's also been in Road Trip, 40 Days and 40 Nights. He's also on the TV show Royal Pains. His twin sister, Alexandra, is played by Missy Pyle, who you may remember from such films as Galaxy Quest, Dodgeball, Big Fish, and Soul Plane. We've already mentioned Alan Cumming. He plays Wyatt. He works for Mega Records. He's the one who discovers the Pussycats in what is one of my favorite shots in the entire film. I'm going to talk about that for a second. The cinematography in the film, they switch lenses to create different moods. Whenever one of the bands meets their screaming fans, they switch to a fisheye lens. So everything looks a little distorted and unreal. And in a behind-the-scenes thing on the DVD where they talk to Deborah and Harry, they said that was deliberate. They wanted those scenes to feel a little unreal and sort of give you the perspective of, you know, what it would be like for, you know, the screaming, obsessed fans to be right there on top of you. And to me, it works. But no, when he discovers the Pussycats, they are running from, well, they had been busking in front of a clothing store. And the manager's like, "I'm going to call the police on you." And at first they don't believe it, but then they hear sirens and they just run out into the street and freeze because Wyatt's driving through town in a SUV and nearly runs them over. So they're just standing there frozen in the headlights, and he picks up a CD case, a clear one, and takes the insert out of it and just lines it up perfectly through the windshield with them like an album cover. Just as some sign makers go by behind them with a big flashing sign that goes, "The number one band in the world." And in what, if I remember right, is the only song not written for the film, Meatloaf's Paradise by the Dashboard Lights swells up. So as all this lines up and like the smoke from the streets, you know, the fog from the streets rolling up behind them and all, and there's like this perfect album cover shot. You hear, you know, Meatloaf belting out, you know, I see Paradise by the Dashboard Lights. It's definitely one of my favorite shots in the film. And then come to find out, watching the film with the commentary on, that the fog was an accident. Apparently there was a car or a trolley car in the area that had overheated, so they just went with it. But Alan Cumming plays Wyatt, and he chews scenery and is a ham like a madman in this film. You've also seen him in films like X-Men 2, Black Beauty, GoldenEye, Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, which gets a small shout-out and a line of dialogue from him, Eyes Wide Shut, and of course Spy Kids, as I mentioned earlier. He also delivers a great line at the beginning when the boy band du jour figures out about the subliminal messages and confronts him on it. Unfortunately, they do this on a plane, and as you find out later on in the film, when you're taken to the headquarters of the conspiracy, there are ways to deal with bands that figure out the truth. One of the most common, the leader says, we got plane crashes, drug overdoses, religious conversions, we got all kinds of ways. So Wyatt immediately just goes up to the cockpit, taps the pilot on the shoulder and goes, we're taking the Chevy to the levee, and then they both parachute out. Now, for the time, that was definitely a joke for the parents in the audience. And you're sitting there going, I don't understand the significance. It's a line from the film. It's a line from the song American Pie by Don McLean. Part of the chorus, take the Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. But the song is about the day the music died, wherein the three of the biggest rock stars at the time, this was in the mid to late 50s, Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper all died in a plane crash. So for that to be the code phrase for we're going to crash the plane, kind of a dark joke if you get it. Alan's boss, and probably the only actor that I would put in a film to try to out-ham and choose scenery more than Alan Cumming, is Fiona, and she's played by Parker Posey. And in fact, there's a scene in the film where Fiona and Wyatt try to out-evil laugh each other. That apparently, according to the writer-directors, was pretty much improvised. They just gave them the idea and then just let them run with it. Parker Posey, of course, you've seen in films like Dazed and Confused, Coneheads, Party Girl. She's been in several of the Christopher Guest mockumentaries like Waiting for Guffman and A Mighty Wind. She was also in The House of Yes. In fact, her and Rachel Lee Cook played the same character at different ages. And Deborah Kaplan and Harry Elfont explained in the behind the scenes and also in the commentary track that they did let the actors have their moments. They talked about Parker Posey actually got them to change part of the script to better fit Fiona, the person Fiona was in her head. Fiona's harboring a secret, which most of the villains in these kind of stories are, and she actually convinced them to change it because she didn't like what they had originally written. And I'm not going to spoil it because the whole point of this podcast is to make you watch the film. Go watch this movie. And of course, Alan M., who we have to talk about, is played by Gabriel Mann, who's been in such films as I Shot Andy Warhol, Planet of the Apes, The Bourne Identity, and been on TV most recently in the CW show Batwoman. And let's take, I don't really do this a lot in the show, but I've got to talk about the soundtrack, because the soundtrack to this film just rocks. I mean, it is a perfect encapsulation of punk pop from late 90s, early 2000s. And weirdly, the soundtrack did much better than the film. I know I don't talk a lot on here about budgets and box offices, but the film cost around $36 million to make and made $14 million at the box office. Like, it didn't even come close to breaking even. And I remember when the film came out, there was like a big media push, at magazine covers, MTV, a lot of commercials, previews. And it really, after watching the film, I could not understand why it didn't catch on. But the soundtrack itself, the soundtrack to this failed film, peaked at 16 on the Billboard charts and was certified gold. And that just blows my mind. But then, you know, like I said, this is a great cast in this film. But, you know, Kaplan and Edmund actually went above and beyond when it comes to the soundtrack. Because what's the point of doing a movie about a band if the music's not going to be good? And so they brought in Kenneth Edmonds, better known as Babyface, who produced half the songs on the album, and helped them find the singing voice for Josie. And in fact, the first choice, and he talks about this, first person he brought in, they rejected not because she wasn't good enough, but in his own words, she was too good for the role. In fact, according to one of the sources that I looked into for the film, they told him she's got a great voice, but could you believe that voice would be coming out of Rachel Lee Cook? The singing voice for Josie in the film is Kay Hanley, who you may recognize as lead singer for Letters to Cleo. They had the song 1994 single Here and Now. They've also had songs on the soundtracks of films like The Craft and 10 Things I Hate About You. They actually had 4 songs on that soundtrack, as well as doing music for the cartoon Generation O. In fact, Kay got so fed up at one point as to whether or not she was going to be the singing voice of Josie that she quit the film and just walked off. And after, you know, Babyface's original singer was rejected, they talked her into coming back and providing the singing voice for Josie. The actresses themselves, however, do sing on the soundtrack. They do all the backing vocals for the Josie and the Pussycat songs. So literally, you know, Melody and Valerie, or Rosario and Tara, do the backing tracks just like their characters do. And according to the actresses, they were taught how to play the songs in the film, not taught how to play the instruments, but they had people on set who taught them you know, how to play the instruments for the specific songs, apparently, so that people wouldn't immediately know they were faking it. But like I said, like this is like a super group of people for a movie soundtrack about Archie comic characters. Like I said, you got Kenneth Babyface Edmonds, who has 12 Grammys, 26 number one hits as a producer, and has worked with groups such as Boys to Men, TLC, worked with Toni Braxton, worked with Whitney Houston. On top of that, you've got behind the scenes people writing and working on and producing additional tracks, including independent Canadian singer Biff Naked, who has also, you know, appeared on soundtracks like Buffy and Ready to Rumble, the David Arquette magnum opus about wrestling. Adam Schlesinger, lead singer of Fountains of Wayne, who unfortunately passed away from COVID, was it last year, I believe? Dave Gibbs of the Gigolo Aunts, Anna Warrinker of That Dog, Jason Faulkner, who plays with Jellyfish, Matthew Sweet, Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's worked on this soundtrack, Adam Duritz from Counting Crows, and of course Kay Hanley and Michael Eisenstein, who were both in Letters to Cleo. Kaplan and Edmund also did help with some of the lyrics, but I mean, honestly, this is like this is a mega super group for a, you know, bubblegum kind of film, just this campy, fun sort of film. All right, so why did it fail, and why in the past few years has it started to gain this cult status? Okay, I have a theory. I mean, I've listened to a few podcasts talking about it, and a lot of people talk about the fact that they're kind of making fun of the very audience they were trying to attract, because it makes fun of teen culture, makes fun of, you know, trends and fashions, and, you know, teen girls. And, you know, this is also around the time that you had, like, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, Avril Lavigne, you know, Spice Girls, you know, the boy groups were starting to come, you know, well, they were in NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, things like that. And people kind of looked down on that style of music, you know, made fun of it. They weren't taken seriously. You know, and the film does kind of make fun, especially of du jour. You know, they're all divas and not very bright divas. And, oh, God, I forgot to tell about, they're not listed in the credits, but du jour is, if you know, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, especially teen comedies, are played by recognizable, well, 3 of them are recognizable. I still don't know where the 4th guy's from, but du jour is played by Brecken Meyer, who, of course, will live forever for the greatest role he ever had in his career as John Arbuckle in the Garfield movies, as well as Can't Hardly Wait. Seth Green, who, again, Can't Hardly Wait, also Oz from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Donald Faison, who is Turk from Scrubs. And this is the second episode in a row we've had somebody from Scrubs mentioned, you know, in the cast of the film. So if you're playing along at home with our drinking game, or I don't know, maybe you just drink while you listen to stuff like the Drunk Theory people, take a sip. And there's a fourth guy. Yeah, but like the film sort of does make fun of that, like the idea that, you know, teenagers are easily manipulated and the subliminal messaging, which is kind of a callback. I know it's been a while back. I talked about the satanic panic in the 80s and the subliminal messages is kind of, you know, obviously taken a reference to that as well. But this is weaponized for the government to sell t-shirts and sneakers and things like that. But it's also got a very positive message. You know, it's like what you like. It's, you know, be the person you want to be. You know, and in fact, there's a moment at the end at the concert when they're getting ready to kick it off when Josie's like, yeah, you know what? We got a new song. We're going to play it. Hope you guys like it. But if you don't, you know what? That's cool, too. And they just play away. Yeah, so like I said, it's a funny film. It's got a great soundtrack. It's got some great shots in it, cinematography, and it's really good. So why did it fail? Honestly, like I said, there's been on different theories I've heard, you know, come out the same week as a bigger film. I believe it was one of the Bridget Jones films, Bridget Jones Diaries films. I've heard people say that it was ahead of its time, you know, and it's satire. I've heard people say that, you know, nobody wanted to see it because they didn't get that it was satire. Yeah, I've heard people say that, you know, because Archie Comics characters, people went into it expecting it to be, you know, I've heard it like a double-edged sword, like the, on the one hand, and this is the one that I kind of subscribe to, the Hanna-Barbera Archie Comics connection, because up to this point, we had had two Flintstones movies, and had the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie come out by this point? But we were starting to mine, you know, we had the Brady Bunch films, and, you know, we were starting to mine, like, you know, the 60s and 70s and bring them into the 90s. But, like I said, the humor in the film just fits right in along with all these other, you know, iterations. You know, it would go right in with the Flintstones and the Brady Bunch films and the Austin Power style films, that campy, kind of light humor. But I do believe, and especially since I found that editorial, that's kind of what kept the film from catching on, is that you had people who remembered the TV show, but you also had a whole generation of people who had read the Archie comics and kind of went into it expecting something a little more family-friendly. Like I said, the jokes are not dirty, but there are some double entendres, but not enough that I really wouldn't take a kid to the film. But I kind of agree with Archie that the PG-13 rating may have helped kill it. Yeah, because you have to understand, at this point in time, the worst thing that had been in Archie comics was, like, in 1994, they did a crossover with the Punisher. Yeah, the only other Archie comics character that was in live action at this point was Sabrina the Teenage Witch, the Melissa Joan Hart show, which was on TGIF Fridays on ABC, owned by Disney. So, you know, there was kind of a level of expectation out of a Josie and the Pussycats movie. And I think the PG-13 and, you know, the fact that it was so different from the cartoon and so different from the characters in the comics, that just that killed it. People just were not expecting that. I think that Archie fans stayed away because they're like, I can't take my kids to this. I mean, PG-13, that's a step down from an R. And then the target audience, the people who would have gone to see it, you know, looked at the PG-13, not been bothered by it, were still thinking, well, you know, it's based on an old cartoon. You know, you look at something like Sabrina, it's probably just going to be, you know, fluff and not really a lot to it. So I think that's why I had difficulty finding an audience in 2001. So why is it starting to have a resurgence now? For the same reason, Archie Comics, since 2001, Archie Comics has done a lot of different things. They're no longer sock hops and, you know, jalopies and, you know, malt shops and, you know, complaining when people get uppity. You know, since this movie come out, Archie in the comics has fought the Predator. Archie has died Archie has fought off a zombie apocalypse. Sabrina the Teenage Witch, both in the comics, because the Netflix show is based on the comics, embraced being an evil witch and doing horrible things. That was the basis for the Netflix TV show. You've had Riverdale come out. Riverdale, the TV show, is such a complete pivot from what, Archie Comics for late 40s, if I remember right, for almost 80 years. Well, 70, because, a lot of the stuff in the comics happened leading up to Riverdale, that it kind of broke people. I mean, I remember when the show first came out, people were still thinking of Archie as, clean cut and just a throwback, like it had nothing of relevance to say about the modern world. And so I think that's kind of what's brought this movie back into the spotlight, is that now people are a little more ready to accept that you can do a more mature Archie Comics character. You can do something that's so different and modern with the characters. And we just, nobody was expecting that 20 years ago. So, I guess, and the way I'm saying it is that Archie Comics is the reason why it didn't succeed at first, and also partly the reason why it's starting to succeed now and find an audience. And it's really a shame because, like I said, this is a great cast, especially the three, the chemistry between Rachel Lee Cook, Tara Reid, and Rosario Dawson is amazing. You believe they've been lifelong friends. Missy Pyle is always great. The way she interacts with the girls, she's not in a lot of scenes, but like I said, it's a really good cast. I don't know if you could have put together a better cast for these characters. The weak link is Alan M, and that whole storyline between him and Josie just kind of seems like they just shoehorned it in because they realized they needed to use the character. And since the movie came out, like they've all had like different career trajectories since then. Rachel Lee Cook's done a lot of independent films and television shows, and I think she did a Hallmark movie or two, which is never really a good sign when you think about it. But Rosario Dawson has had a resurgence in her career. She's been doing a lot of good work. She's now got a role in Star Wars. Tara Reid, at first it seemed like Tara Reid had, this film didn't really affect her career, because like after this, she still did Van Wilder. She still did some rom-coms. What was the one, My Boss's Daughter with Ashton Kutcher. Then she kind of fell off a little bit in the long run as well. I remember, God, what was that show? I think her lowest point in her career, I'm not talking about her. I mean, she's, I don't want anybody to think that I'm bad-mouthing her, but I do remember like her career kind of fell off when she started hosting that TV show. I think it was used to be called Wild on E! Network, and then they changed it to Terradice when she took over, and then got canceled in a month because by that point she kind of had a reputation for a party girl. And even for that show, they were like, I remember people would be talking about, basically the show should be called, Is This the Week Tara Reid Dies of Alcohol Poisoning? But it just kind of bugs me, because it's like, if the film had done better, what would the three of them have been able to accomplish? What would their career paths have been like? Especially because this film was, according to a couple of sources I saw, supposed to be the kickoff of a Hanna-Barbera shared universe, like film series. Like, it was supposed to be Josie and the Pussycats, and then they were going to do Scooby-Doo next, which they did. They did two Scooby-Doo movies. But no, apparently, the Josie and the Pussycats was supposed to kick off, and we would have, if it had been more successful, we would have gotten a string of movies based around Hanna-Barbera characters. Kind of like what they teased at the end of the animated Scoob movie, which came out, 2020, something like that. So we're going to wrap it up. I know I've run a little longer than I really intended to, but I genuinely, unironically, and shamelessly love this film. It's just hilarious. It's just a fun, it's a film you put in to watch that just leaves you feeling good. There's nothing really bad about it. I'm not going to sit here and say it's the greatest film in the world, but it is, it's just a fun film. It's just something to sit down and laugh and enjoy and not worry about everything in the world for, 90 minutes. And it's got a soundtrack. It's a great soundtrack. If you can watch this film and not find yourself still thinking about or humming the songs a couple of days later, you're a better person than me. I can't do it. Every time I watch it, I've spent a week with the song stuck in my head. So I guess we already know the answer to it, but it's time to ask the most important question in the world. Was it entertaining? And hell yes, watch this film, especially if you got kids. I mean, it's just a fun movie. It is one of those. There's some jokes you're going to get and they're not going to get. It's campy. It's smarter than a lot of people have given it credit for. And the Blu-ray is really cheap. So, you know, you're going to buy the Blu-ray. Don't rent this because you're going to watch it more than once. Just go buy the Blu-ray. $10. It's $10 on Amazon right now as I'm recording this. So what's next week's film? That's a good question. I actually had two different ones in mind, only to find out that neither one of them is available on any of the streaming services that I am currently subscribed to. I'm not subscribed to all of them. I have a budget, people. So we are going with a more recent film. We've gone from 2001. We're going now to 2017, I believe. No, 2018, with The Death of Stalin. Joseph Stalin, the Russian leader. It's apparently a very dark comedy, but I saw the trailer for it and I had to add it to the list. It just looked absolutely insane. So we're going to go with that because I do have that one on a streaming service that I follow. If you'd like to see more of my ramblings or hear more of them, you can follow me on Twitter at CFeverDreams. You can follow me on Instagram or TikTok at CelluloidFeverDreams. You know, feel free to reach out to me on any of them if you want to correct me on something or if you want to suggest a future film. If you're looking for more, I'm going to do this real quick. If you're looking for more podcasts to listen to, you want to laugh a little, well, not going to say a little, you want to just laugh. I've already mentioned them, but the guys and gals over at Drunk Theory is a good listen, as well as some guys I actually got to hang out with a couple of weeks ago. The guys over at Esoterica Cinema, they're kind of like me. They do offbeat films or films you may not have heard of and do some discussions about them. A couple of good guys, a couple of good podcasts to follow and support. If you want to see what other movies I watch besides the ones for my podcast, you can, I forgot to mention this earlier, you can also follow me on Letterboxd, just Wyndham Jennings, Wyndham. So that's going to wrap it up. Hope you guys had fun, enjoyed hanging out with you. Glad that you let me be just a small part of your day or your week. And remember, there's a lot of things you can be in life. Kind is one of the better ones, especially to yourself. And until next week, I've been Wyndham Jennings. This has been Celluloid Fever Dreams, and I'll be saving you a seat until next time. Have a good night, Betamaxers.